Good morning or good weekend, whenever you're listening to this. This is Nathaniel from The Film Experience, and I'm here with Katie Rich.
Hi there.
Joe Reed.
Hello.
Nick Davis.
Hey.
So we're all here, and we're going to be talking about how we spent our summers, or rather, our favorite things about our summer movie viewings.
Yes. Not in general how we spent our summers, because that would just be a lot of me sitting in front of my air conditioner, right. Avoiding the outside.
Katie's
would be like a lot of like dancing the nene. And...
a lot of hip rooftop parties, guys, with other youthful people, just enjoying life.
Man,
you're
really right.
Trying to show us up. In one
I have been to zero rooftop parties. This is clear.
I did ask you all to prepare like 10 things, but I didn't really necessarily tell you to rank them or anything like that. So I don't know if we ranked. I guess what we'll do is we'll just this will be very erratic because we'll just each take a turn.
Okay.
As we count down our 10 things, and if we overlap, then we can save time.
Okay.
It can be like categories. If you say something that somebody else has, cross it off your list.
Yes. Right. Make a game of it. I love it.
And you get the most points if you liked the weirdest shit that everybody else hated.
Yes.
Wait, that wasn't part of the rules. I would have changed my list.
Listen, life is like that, though. You get more points in life if you like things that other people didn't like, because you're an iconoclast.
That's true.
If the internet has taught us nothing else.
That's right. Okay, so you said we could rank movies or, like, things from movies, so I did more of... I did a little combination platter, but I did a little bit of platter.
Okay.
So my first thing is the color schemes in both Mad Max Fury Road and Slow West, which I thought were two of the more interesting, and it's not all of Slow West, but there are scenes in Slow West where I thought the colors were incredibly, in that same Mad Max kind of way, sort of bright and primary in a way that I was not expecting, and in general was what made me like that movie, which... I think I tweeted, like, I was watching it on demand, so I was doing that awful obnoxious thing where, like, I'm tweeting while I'm watching because I'm a jerk. But I sort of halfway through, I was just like, well, they didn't call it Fast West. Like, it was moving at a deliberate pace. But there's the last half hour of that movie, maybe like the last 20 minutes, is really captivating and really well done and really makes incredibly good use of, like, the blue of the sky contrasted to, like, the sort of yellows of the house, the fields and stuff like that, in a way that I thought was captivating, and in a way that movies of that type don't seem to feel the need to be, which was also what I felt about Mad Max, was sort of going the extra mile to give you that kind of visually arresting feel in a season where we've sort of become conditioned to accept less than that. So I liked that.
Here, here.
Yeah.
I think going the extra mile could be said in general about Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, I think, yeah, the extra 75 miles. But yes.
Right.
I can jump in with mine because Mad Max is the only one I just listed as a movie on my list because I couldn't really single out the one thing I wanted to talk about from it. And it's existence, it's going the extra mileness, the fact that it was a hit. Like all of those, basically everything about its presence in the summer, I totally loved. So thank God for Mad Max.
That is the only one I listed as just a movie too. So there we go.
It's funny that you mentioned it as a hit because I feel like I've heard it described as both a hit and not a big enough hit, depending on what kind of point a given writer wants to make about the summer season.
I think it's still a pretty solid hit. It just was expensive, so I guess that's
I agree with you, and I feel like, especially given not as marketable things about it in terms of... There was a lot of things that may have kept people away, and still, and even still, for this movie to have done as well as it did.
It's also worth noting that Mad Max, the franchise, was never a massive hit franchise.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly, totally.
So it's done... especially considering all the years off and that it isn't a major part of the culture, I think the numbers are very, very good on it.
Yeah, I would agree.
Why don't we jump to Nick?
Well, I had trouble fitting in my honorable mentions, which were The Cure at the end of Ant-Man and how hot that blonde guy was in Spy, who dies in the courtyard. That was a Kirk, you know. But number 10 was Elizabeth Banks in Love and Mercy, because I was just so surprised at that performance, and it makes me more interested in other things that she might do. And it made me more interested in the movie, which I didn't expect to be interested in at all.
I don't know if the rest of us are going to talk about Pitch Perfect or anything, but Elizabeth Banks had, like, the summer. She chose it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what kind of, like, magic lamp she got or whatever, but whatever she did it right this year.
One of my very top ones, I did list them in loose order, was Expectations Thwarted in general, and Elizabeth Banks is one of the, you know, rungs in that, uh-huh. one of the spokes in that wheel, and also, like, just being very surprised that Mission Impossible Rogue Nation was as good as Ghost Protocol, which I was not expecting. Like, that franchise just either stays the same in level of quality or gets better, which mm-hmm. is just not what franchises do. So I was very surprised by that. Super surprised at just the tone and that Guy Ritchie didn't care about guns that much in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and it was all about, like, style, which I thought was very cool. And Inside Out being a return to form, I was very doubtful, unlike a lot of people, just because I've been very soured on the direction Pixar's been going in, but expectations thwarted. It's one of my favorite things.
I had part of Inside Out on mine, but specifically thinking about Amy Poehler's presence in that movie and how, even though Parks and Recreation was kind of this underwatched gem, that her performance in that movie kind of makes her our national emblem of hope and optimism, which is what she was as Leslie Knope on Parks and Rec, because her voice is so perfect for it, and her persona is so great for it. The way she has, you know, has a whole web series about smart girls, and I think her presence in the world reminds you to not fall into cynicism the way it is in Inside Out and in pop culture is really valuable. And I love that movie, and I thought she was such a huge part of why it was so wonderful.
That's a really great point. It's a really good niche because not very many people fill it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That being that whole emblem.
Do fill it. Seem like they're just kind of relentlessly optimistic and aren't paying attention. And she knows every single thing that's going on and still mm-hmm. keeps right. that.
Nathaniel mentioned Man from U.N.C.L.E. a bit ago, and that movie in general was such a delightful surprise for me. Man from U.N.C.L.E. had 3 or 4 different scenes, like the car chase at the beginning, the scene where Elizabeth Debicki poisons Henry Cavill.
Oh, that's the best, like, scene.
There are just, and that's another movie that sort of goes that extra mile to just really throw things in there that are going to kind of delight you beyond what needs to do. The costumes are fantastic, and the actors, who are not my favorite, like, collection of actors, like, I was hard-pressed to find much good feeling about Armie Hammer going into that movie, but I thought he was, like, incredibly charming, and Cavill's incredibly charming, and I think Vikander is sort of maybe the weak link of the four, but, like, if that's your weak link, you're doing pretty well.
Wow, that's, yeah.
I would actually agree with that, which very much surprised me, because I think she's such a great actor, but in that particular quartet,
everybody else really steps up, like, and is trying something, and I don't know, I was expecting that to be, you know, such a dud.
Okay, I just went back in chronological order, so even the Fast and Furious 7, I basically don't remember anything about it at this point. It came out 100 years ago, but the car stunt where he drives the car through, I think, 2 different skyscrapers is just, it's wonderful. I love bonkers action sequences. I love when they are involved some amount of real things in the world. I think the summer was actually pretty good for action sequences in general, but that one, I remember seeing it in the Super Bowl trailer and, like, clapping my hands with glee, and then it was so delightful. And I think the Fast and Furious franchise may go on for the rest of my life, but if they can come up with something like that once in a while, I will keep watching. So I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah, agreed.
Nick?
I liked the movie Tangerine, not as a whole enough to be on this list, but the parts of it that I liked, which were every time the screen shook because the music was so loud while somebody stomped down the sidewalk, were like my favorite parts of the summer. And so was this, the movie existed and was cast with trans actors and even got the level of attention that it did. That was really gratifying. Mm-hmm. And it's a good movie that people should keep trying to find.
Yeah, I also had that on my list, and specifically the music. I love that I love that it charged Cindy's moods. That bus stop scene is one of the funniest scenes this summer for me. Just where she's calming down and there's classical music and all of a sudden it's the shakiness again. And then she jumps back up all newly angry. I think the music is really funny in that movie. And also I had music slash laundromat because the finale of Tangerine is just so affecting. Yeah. After all this sort of like broad like screaming for a lot of the movie.
And we talked about this a lot on the podcast we did about Tangerine, but because it's shot on an iPhone and for other reasons you hear about, like it seems like not the sort of movie you need to rush to see in a theater, but it's quite theatrical, especially with that sound mix and the colors. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad I saw it in that environment.
But okay, I'll go to something more controversial. I want to give a shout out to the sequence in Avengers: Age of Ultron, the birth of the Vision. There, you know, people, that movie hit just as people were kind of like, enough, you know, with the superheroes. And even though it was like an enormous worldwide success, people are very, very snarky about it. And I saw it recently for the third time because I was on a plane. And I think it is so much better than it gets credit for. It has all the problems people are saying it has, but Josh Whedon's voice still comes through. And there's enough idiosyncratic stuff that people are just not appreciating because they're tired of superhero movies. Mm-hmm. And I think that sequence is an example of his weird sort of turn on a dime tonal capabilities as a director. Because it starts out as sort of this tense action scene and then it like moves directly into like floating serenity, like sort of existentialism. I think it's just a really interesting sequence, and I think Paul Bettany is great in the role, in a very difficult role that could have been very cheesy.
Yeah, and speaking of sort of experiences, seeing things in the theater, the moment where Vision is able to pick up the hammer with sort of the ease that he is.
Yes.
The reaction in my theater was so delightfully wonderful, where everybody just sort of like gasped and then kind of laughed how everybody gasped at once.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite reactions in a movie crowd, like of all time. Like it's that, you know, you caught yourself by surprise and everybody at once has caught themselves by surprise, which I liked. I've got Age of Ultron on mine, but mine is Scarlett Johansson in Age of Ultron, partly because the nature of Black Widow's character in that movie was such a lightning rod for controversy and criticism and think pieces this summer about, you know, what the movie was saying about her and about womanhood and what's her role as basically the only major woman superhero. What ended up getting lost in this sort of zeal to make a point was some of the actual truth of the storyline, where I think there was a lot of willful misinterpretation of what the movie was saying about Black Widow being fertile. I think it's tough for me to imagine watching that movie and feeling like the movie is nodding in agreement with, you know, how she's punishing herself for, you know, the way she interprets her infertility and saying, you know, we're all monsters or something like that. I think you have to maybe, you know, stretch a little bit to try and feel like the movie is, you know, judging her. That franchise, especially the two Joss Whedon movies, have really taken not only care in developing her character, but clearly enjoy watching that character operate. I would like a Black Widow standalone movie too, but in many ways, the two Avengers movies feature that character as much as anybody else, and, you know, in many ways...
And the Captain America movie.
Yeah, exactly. But in many ways, she's like the focal point of both of those Avengers movies. There's a degree to which Black Widow got a little bit of a short shrift in think piece season this summer.
Well, and also because I just want, just one thing about what you said. Also because her reference to herself as a monster is clearly not solely about the fact that she can't have children, but that she's an assassin and she was trained to like murder people. She's talking about that as well. It seems, it does seem like people were willfully obtuse because they wanted to be angry, because, again, they were just sick of, you know, superhero movies. And, you know, Marvel brought that on themselves, whatever. So you can't feel too bad for the movie's reception, but the reason I put it on my list is I enjoyed watching it in the theater, and even though it has struggles being a cohesive movie, it has a lot of great elements.
I had her on my list. I had Avengers on my list as well, but for Scarlett Johansson and Mark Ruffalo having a romance between the two of them, even though it's in the context of this kind of jumbled movie, which I think I only saw it the one time, but I don't have that fond memories of it like Nathaniel does. But I think we tend not to appreciate that we have Mark Ruffalo in these movies on a regular basis, and like how incredible it is that he is playing the Incredible Hulk. And I really liked the two of them together. I thought their romance got like, it was weirdly shoehorned into the story. There didn't seem to be a lot of room for it, but I buy the two of them together. I like them together. I want them to like there's a scene at the Tony Stark's house where they're like flirting by the bar, and it's like, okay, yeah, I'd watch an entire movie of that. And so I have no idea how much this is going to play out in any future movies. He's got to, like, go into space, according to some rumors, so I have no idea. But,
They're all going to end up in space at some point.
That's true. They'll all be on the Rainbow Bridge in Asgard. I think we need to appreciate when we have two attractive, charismatic actors in a romance together, no matter what the context.
Yeah.
How about Nick? We'll jump ahead to Nick. Because I'm betting you don't have Age of Ultron on your list.
Or even in my life. This is the most I've ever heard about it. But my favorite superhero is obviously Tilda Swinton, and both moments in Trainwreck where she says, "Is this your one-woman show? Because I didn't buy a ticket." By itself.
Is that one of your list entries?
Yes.
Awesome.
Well, when she's a Doctor Strange, everything will finally come together.
That's true. It's the singularity we've all been waiting for.
Tilda Swinton, superhero.
I don't have Tilda on my list for shame, but I do have Trainwreck specifically for the Staten Island Walk of Shame at the beginning of the movie. Amazing. Because there was something about Amy Schumer in high heels walking across that broken sidewalk that made me laugh so much that I had to like catch my breath. And I love moments like that in the theater.
Especially because she let it run kind of long.
Right.
Like many things in Trainwreck, she let it run a little long.
Yeah.
But in that case, it worked.
But that was the best version of letting something run. You know, it took her like 2 minutes to cross one panel of the sidewalk.
I had Trainwreck on my list, too, for letting Bill Hader's inherent sexiness shine through, because I've always thought he was a dreamboat, and I think Trainwreck does a really good job of showing why, even though the relationship between the two of them was not really that well-developed as far as I'm concerned. I don't totally get why they're together, but I totally get why she would want to be with him, which is, I don't know, that's like half the battle.
Yeah, I would line up.
His career's really picked up.
Oh, yeah.
And, like
the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay, Joe, I think it's you.
Oh, okay. So, well, I didn't have anything on Trainwreck. Not that I didn't like Trainwreck, because I really did. But I had the airplane scene from Spy with Melissa McCarthy and Rose Byrne. Not purely for the sad clown part joke, even though that's phenomenal. But just the whole thing, I feel like I could have done with, you know, a 90-minute movie of those two on a plane. It was just sort of gem shining in the middle of it for me, and I thought McCarthy and Rose Byrne worked so well opposite each other and sort of just bouncing off of one another. I easily laughed harder at that than anything else, any other scene and anything else this summer. I thought it was wonderful.
That was also on my list, so now I'm down to four things.
I'll do several really quickly. The tense rapport or non-rapport between the two leads of End of the Tour, Lipsky and Wallace. And I don't have any relationship to David Foster Wallace. I've never read anything by him, so I didn't care about that movie as a portrait of him. But watching two men who are kind of sympathetic to each other, nonetheless kind of needle each other or be jealous or freaked out by each other was really fascinating.
Basically the same thing on my list for End of the Tour, and how so much of what is weird between them is unsaid and never really needs to draw a line to why they have this tense relationship. You kind of infer it, and I thought it such a great show for that.
The concert scenes from Straight Outta Compton, which were my favorite part of that movie, and I thought do a really good job capturing how vibrant and how kind of dangerous that music was at that time. And the end credits of Inside Out, where we, I know I'm saying this to cat people, but where we see the cat, I'm sorry, that seems plausible to me.
I laugh about that joke sometimes just like riding the subway, just thinking about it.
Yeah, that was the funniest joke in the movie for me, and I'm a cat lover, so.
Okay, so am I the only person here who saw A Little Chaos?
I saw it as well.
It's not a great movie, but like it's one of those movies where you walk out and just like, God, the costumes and the music were wonderful. Like, and you don't want to talk about the actual story or the plot or anything like that. But there's a scene in that movie where it's really the one scene that really hit me as a story, as a narrative, as whatever, where Kate Winslet as this woman who's designing this garden theater ballroom at Versailles ends up in this sort of ante room waiting to have an audience with King, and it's all the women, all the sort of mistresses, and some of them I think are wives, and basically it's just sort of like, well, here are all the women, and we're going to have this sort of unexpectedly kind of lovely and honest and sort of stripped down scene where they're just talking. They're all just sort of like sharing their stories, and Jennifer Ely is there.
Oh, she's so good in that movie too.
She's so, it's one of those really great, really small performances in a movie this year, in a movie that will, you know, easily be forgotten by the end of the year, and in many ways justifiably so. But like, it's mm-hmm. it's worth it for some of its parts.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to one movie on my list that is not a good movie, but I want to include it, Pitch Perfect 2, because for me, it reminds me specifically of what is special about summer movie season, in that it tends to be the season where people will see things that they don't even really care if they're great or not, because it's like fun to go to the movies with your friends in the summer.
Yeah.
There's just something mm-hmm. about it. And like I had two friends flying in who loved the first movie, and they happened to be in town the weekend it opened. So we went with a group of like 8 of us, which is, I usually go to the movies alone, you know, so that's like a big change for me.
That's like, and you're in middle school again, going to the movies with a pack of friends.
Yeah.
And I had such a good time, even though the entire time I was like, this movie is not very good, but I had the biggest ball watching it. And so like the idea of event season being more about the community of sitting in a movie theater is important, I think.
Yeah.
And it's nice when the movies go the extra mile, like Mad Max. but even, you know, movies that aren't great can sometimes be thrilling to see in the theater specifically for that reason.
I have the polar opposite of that, which might be a decent transition, in that I have caught up with a fair amount of 2015 movies, not even summer movies, on iTunes and Amazon and not Netflix, I guess. But I feel like this summer, either it's me realizing it or it is more available. But the extent to which 2015 movies are available for me to watch at my house when I have a free evening has really been great. Like, I've been able to catch up on so much. And for, you know, I think summer is as much about staying in your air-conditioned home as it is about going to the movie theater and being able to catch all of this stuff in my house. I mean, you know, long live the VOD revolution. I'm totally fine. I think I'm going to watch Deep for Zachariah when I get off this podcast. And I'm really happy that when I don't get to make it to screenings, which I don't get to do very much, I can catch up on all this stuff at home.
Speaking of Deep for Zachariah, that is on my list. I really liked it. And it's Craig Zobel, who directed Compliance. And there's really not a lot of connective tissue between this and Compliance, except I guess you could probably draw a line between kind of the complicated ways that people lie to each other, I guess. Like, there's a lot in Z for Zachariah about, you know, how honest characters are allowing themselves to be with other people, and how sort of, you know, holding their tongue about certain things will be more expedient, and expediency is valuable in this sort of post-apocalyptic world. But Margot Robbie and Chiwetel Ejiofor and Chris Pine are really, really sort of great and thorny and knotty in their relationships to each other. And it gave me a lot to sort of think about and talk about.
How about Nick?
We just had a podcast discussion about I'll See You in My Dreams, so you can just refer back to that discussion. But if there's one scene in it, it might be the 4 women getting high and going to buy Fruity Pebbles. And
oh my June's god.
to explain her with all of them having to explain why they're high on the side of the road eating breakfast cereal, but really the whole movie.
Yeah, and which comes out on DVD next week, I think.
Yeah, was that true?
Yeah.
Oh, see it. Oh. Everybody highly recommended. I really, really loved that movie. That's on my list too. But it's in general that summer movie season, because of counter programming for blockbusters, this summer movie season has been a great year for older ladies.
Yeah, and the theme of our very last podcast, old lady movies.
Yeah, like. You don't have to wait for the fall to see old ladies in the big screen. Like, if you are fortunate enough to live in a city that will show these smaller movies, you can spend your summer watching, you know, Lily Tomlin beat the shit out of Nat Wolf, and, like, you know, live get high with her friends, and Meryl Streep play a Pink song for some reason. I don't know. I had ups and downs with Ricky and the Flash, but, like, it's great that movie, you know, was such a big part of the, you know, the mainstream this summer.
Not an old lady, but a lady we have not seen enough of. Jada Pinkett Smith coming back in Magic Mike XXL and, like, yes, dominating every single one of her scenes. And, like, I want to spin off about her right now. She was just so great in that. It was so fun to see her, even though, I mean, I thought that movie's shaggy plot was kind of unforgivable in bars because it didn't have any narrative drive. But as long as that scene at her house lasts, it's so fun to watch her. And I'm so glad she's back. I really hope she takes this as an excuse to do campy stuff or whatever. She has so much power and so much persona. I really can't remember the last time I thought that, or if I've ever thought that. And I was so grateful for her in that movie that I really enjoyed overall.
My number two on this list was every part of the movie that she's in. And I know that, Nathaniel, you said that, like, you found it confounding that she is so foregrounded at the end of the movie. But the sequence at her estate and the whole final bit, and even just her warning the audience about some grown woman ass shit up in here at the end of the show, like, perfection.
I liked her at the end. I thought by the time she was asking for permission to call the ladies in the audience queens, I was all about it. But the sequence at her sort of, like, maison derrière or whatever, where, like, what was so stylized like an episode of True Blood for some reason.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't quite understand why this was this, like, Anne Rice plantation home came out of, like, nothing, and all of a sudden, why is everything like the Vampire Lestat? And, like, I kept worrying that she was gonna, like, murder somebody for some reason, not because of, like, the way the story was going, but just the way that everything was stylized in that whole sequence felt so odd and not seemingly in a way that the movie was going towards, where, like, the Andy McDowell scene, which also seemed to take place in a mansion from the Vampire Lestat.
I thought they were going to get murdered there. I had definitely
like that. Well, that was the whole fucking movie was like that, where, like, all of a sudden, on this, like, unexpectedly harrowing journey to Fort Lauderdale or wherever the hell they were going. And, like, I didn't quite understand why everything felt like an episode of The Walking Dead, where they were just going to, like, at any point run into a band of people who were going to kill them. But, like, at least in the Andy McDowell part, it was shorter and, I thought, funnier, where it was just, I don't know, I couldn't get on board with whatever tone they were trying to go for in the Jada Mansion part, but I did love her at the end.
It's funny that this came up at all, because I do have the whole entire sequence at Andy McDowell's house on my list.
Yeah.
I love everything about that sequence, from, like, the camaraderie of Andy and her girls, to Matthew Bomer singing, to that hilarious, like, physical comedy that Channing does when he spins around saying his name. It's just, I yeah. just found that part of the movie so delightful, and I wish the whole movie had been that good.
I watched on Netflix some night this summer, Beauty Shop. Has anybody else seen Beauty Shop here? The spin-off sequel to Barbershop? The Queen Latifah one, yes. Andie MacDowell basically plays the same woman in both
really?
Of those movies. And it and to the point where I kind of want Magic Mike Double XL to be like part of the Beauty Shop cinematic universe in a way. But like I just want somebody to tell me like, no, that was the same woman. That like we ended up, you know, where she's just this, it's exactly the same person. It's crazy. And she's also the best part of Beauty Shop, so there we go.
I mean, having known a lot of Southern women in their 50s who sit around drinking wine, I believe that Annie MacDowell maybe is that person. She's South Carolina-ish. Yeah. She knows that world.
Yeah. Okay, this one is really small, and I talked about Ricky and the Flash a little bit, but every time they cut away to Ben Platt as the bartender in Ricky and the Flash, I was so delighted, where I was just like he was so enthusiastic about Ricky, and like they managed to cut away to him at least 20 times during those barroom scenes where he was just like, I love you, woo, right? And he was her confidant, and then he shows up at the wedding at the end.
Yeah, what the hell?
Honestly, no reason, but that was part of the charm of the end of that movie, was for all of my problems that I may have had with the movie, if you're going to end a movie with a big giant wedding dance sequence with a song and with characters showing up for no reason except for the fact that you like them, like, fine. Like, I will absolutely surrender my
thing.
But he
was that. Like the stand-in for all the Meryl Streep stands in the world,
of
right?
Of course he was! He yeah. was like Meryl Streep's gay fandom personified.
I have, you know, costumes in general, but more specifically, you know, I could have had a whole top 10 on costumes, but I do want to shout out the costumes in Far From the Madding Crowd. It's one of the 10 pleasures of the season. Like, Janet Patterson has done great work before in better movies and such, but I really thought, like, every choice just, I was like, yes! This
what
is just so smart.
Or does she go to? Like, what mood in the sky has these prints? Movie after movie after movie.
Yeah, I was really surprised at how rich the costumes were without drawing attention to themselves in the way, like, I don't want to diss a movie that I think has great costumes, but it's true what people say about it, Cherie with Michelle Pfeiffer. Where I think maybe Nick, it was you who said it's like every shot of the costumes is like for your consideration. Like this movie doesn't seem to be like spending a lot of time going, wow, look at this, but like the costumes are amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't keep straight if Far From the Madding Crowd was spring or summer, but it absolutely would have been on my list for those costumes. It's for every reason you said. The Ricky and the Flash wedding was a sort of runner-up for me, too, but while we're on the subject of Meryl, one of mine is the publication at long last of Mike Nichols' Sex, Language, and the Reinvention of Psychological Realism by Kyle Stevens to this site, and it's, as you hear from the title, mostly a study of Nichols, but that itself is great because he's the kind of actor-driven and sort of writing-associated director that doesn't get a lot of academic attention, but there's incredible attention to the kind of acting that he pulled out of his cast, especially Streep. There's stuff about how Nichols uses sound, how he uses editing, and it's a great read. I'm not even finished with it yet, and really distinctive from what you read in the popular press and what you read in academia. So buy
I'm
that
excited
book.
To read it.
And there's a great chapter on Streep at the end of that book that fans like the bartender should definitely read.
It's a good summer for the Film Experience extended family.
Yes, a lot of new books, yes. Making me feel unaccomplished. I should probably try to get a book published.
I went on vacation when Terminator Genesis came out, and it's as if it never happened. I never had thought about it. I never saw it, never will, and the original Terminator is still out there. So it's really, I love it when a terrible blockbuster just vanishes from sight and you never have to consider it.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
That's maybe my favorite entry of this entire podcast.
I think I just want to sign Katie's list. And pretend it was mine.
Yeah, my last two are both just sort of like movies in their entirety. And I don't think, I'm pretty sure we haven't talked about either one of them on this podcast. But Amy and Diary of a Teenage Girl were these really wonderful little gems out there in this summer season. Again, like the counter programming in Summer Season has become so, so, so good. And that's why August, I can't sort of even like scoff at August anymore for being like dumping ground. Like, of course it is for, you know, some big things, but it's, you know, it's a really great opportunity to find some of these indie Sundance movies that that have filtered into the multiplex. I thought Amy was fascinating. I realized how little I actually knew about Amy Winehouse's life and career. I was sort of, it was one of those things where like, wow, that happened. And then, you know, the two or three things I sort of knew about Amy Winehouse's career, sort of like watching them pop up in now all of this context about her life and about her family. And it tells this really sort of fascinating and sad story. And then Diary of a Teenage Girl, I thought I had seen Belle Powley is the name of the girl in that movie. And I had seen her on Broadway several years ago. She was in the Broadway production of Arcadia, the one with Billy Crudup. And wow. She was very young and, in my opinion, not quite there yet. In terms of, like, she certainly wasn't somebody who was just like, this girl is going to, like, you know, take it by storm. But I was amazed and gratified by how interesting of a performance she gives in Diary of a Teenage Girl. It's one of the, you know, two or three must-see performances of the summer.
Nick? Diary of a Teenage Girl, on the whole, is my number one also. I just saw it a couple months ago, and every single thing about it just floored me. It's so funny. It's amazingly realized just at the visual and sort of soundtrack levels for something that probably had, you know, 15 cents.
Yeah.
She's extraordinary. Kristen Wiig and Alexander Skarsgård are in really tricky parts. They're really good. The other friends of Belle Powley's character are great. The animated embellishments don't make you feel like you're just watching a Juno imitation. It's doing its own thing for sure. I loved that movie.
Katie, what's your number one?
Okay, so none of us have brought up Jurassic World, which I think is kind of fitting, like at least in my opinion. Like that movie, I saw that movie, I felt fine about it, and then it took over the world, which I'm continually baffled by. But I did think the whole controversy around the shoes in it was really indicative of a lot of its problems, which is why when I saw Mission Impossible, I was so thrilled to see the moment where she takes off her shoes when they're escaping the opera scene, which I also really loved as a Hitchcock tribute. I thought that was really well done. I just think that her removing her shoes to be as good, and she's such a great character in general, it was just really telling of when a blockbuster is paying attention and when it is what is following what its characters would actually be doing, even in a movie as crazy and cartoony as Mission Impossible. So as much as that kind of shoe drama was overblown by the internet, as have many things this summer been, I thought that comparison was really indicative of when a blockbuster is caring and, you know, going doing that extra like we've been talking about. I guess, you know, being female, but also just anytime I see a woman in heels in a scene, I'm just like, dude, take them off.
Oh, my
Bryce Dallas Howard has worked there forever, and there's no reason she would dress like that. Anyway, this is not about Jurassic World. Sorry, Joe.
My friend Tara and I do a podcast about Hollywood Game Night, that NBC.
It is great, even if you don't watch the show.
We record just like 25 minutes of us talking about it right after the show, but every time we get very much invested in the women who at some point just like decide to take off their shoes because they are not screwing around. There are games where you have to be up and move around, and like, and we get so mad at the women who don't take off their shoes because it's just like, no, you are not plugged in enough. You are not taking it seriously enough. You need to be here to win, and to be here to win, you need to be in flats or in stocking feet. Like, that's
the first
all
one to show up in sneakers is going to be have you like your eternal.
Oh my God! Can you imagine? Oh my, it could be like Jessica Biel, and she could show up in sneakers, and I'd be like, queen.
You're
like,
a genius.
Yeah, exactly.
My number one is, and this is going to shock everyone, is just a general shout out to male actors.
How dare you disrespect?
So right now, I said you're being so weird right now.
No, but I was realizing like there were so many situations this summer where I was like really impressed with, you know, the male cast of something or male performances. I was like, what is happening? Like, I thought Sam Elliott, we talked about this on the last podcast, but I thought he was so good in both of his movies. I thought Nicholas Holt stepped up his game, like, incredibly for Mad Max. Michael Peña was the obvious highlight of Ant-Man. Mm-hmm. And then there was, I don't know if any of you saw this, but the Stanford Prison Experiment. that was one of those movies where I was like, I could see this being a movie where later on people refer back to it as like, look at all these stars from this movie. You know, like people, the way people look back on like The Outsiders or School Ties. Because there are just so many like young, talented male actors in it, because it's basically an all-male movie. Including some I hadn't seen before. So I was like, this is... And everybody was pretty good in it. Or very good. So...
Who, like, are some of the actors?
Oh, sorry.
Ezra Miller is one of them, I
think. Yeah, Ezra Miller has a big part. Michael...
Oh, I'm looking at this cast right now. That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, Michael...
Keir Gilchrist, Thomas Mann, wow.
Yeah, Michael Angarano has a really big part.
Nice.
I don't know if
Love
I'm saying
Michael
his...
Angarano.
I don't know if I'm saying his name right.
I don't know.
Ty Sheridan's in it. I mean, there's just like a bunch of people, and you know, some I hadn't seen before. And I think it could be one of those movies where later on, like School Ties, where like everyone famous is in it and you just didn't know them at the time. So basically, I was just, you know, continually like, wow, men are really trying to be as good as women this summer.
And you know, summer movie season is usually so inhospitable to men that I'm really glad they had a chance to step up.
No, but I mean, even when they lead movies, they're not the most interesting thing about it. So that's why that's why I wanted to point that out. And you know, my favorite part of Pitch Perfect 2 was that German guy that's a YouTube star. I just thought he was so funny.
The sidekick to the villains.
He was one of the two villains.
The guy. Yeah.
Yeah, and so there were just so many examples where I was like, what is happening? So I just thought I should do that, you know.
Recognize that you can overcome your bias towards actresses when the moment is right.
Right.
I think we all did this. I wound up not saying anything about movies that I technically saw a while ago that opened this summer. But, you know, if it exhorts people to go make sure they catch Look of Silence or Pigeons Out on a Branch or The Tribe or whatever, those were kind of summer highlights but just weren't for the summer for me.
So thanks for tuning in to our summers, and we'll talk to you again soon.